So I now have a coffin shaped in the form of the Empire State Building.
Oh my! What do you think like in your? Is that in your apartment, or where do you keep it?
It is in my apartment.
This week on Two Boomer Babes, a former FBI art sleuth makes friends with the mob and travels the world in search of stolen masterpieces.
Did you know there's an upside to being irrational?
Hey, I've tried to tell my husband that.
Well, we'll hear how to get the most good and the least bad out of ourselves.
Next, everything you're dying to know about death but we're afraid to ask, how cultures mourn and celebrate their dead.
Finally, the business of funeral homes for pets. It's heavenly.
Robert Whitman had a fascinating 20-year career as the FBI's art sleuth. He went undercover to catch art thieves, scammers, black market traders, and even members of the mob. His results were nothing short of spectacular, recovering hundreds of millions of dollars worth of masterpieces and rare historic artifacts. His memoir, co-authored with John Schiffman, is called Priceless: How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. Robert joins us on the phone from somewhere in the world. Great to have you join us, Robert.
Hey, Kathy and Barb. Nice to be here.
Well, you begin your whole story by taking your reader on quite a ride through South Beach as you attempt to recover a collection of masterpieces valued at $500 million. And the story involves two crazy Frenchmen, a Rolls Royce, a yacht, a Colombian drug dealer, bikini-clad, strawberry-eating babes. I mean, if this doesn't sound like a movie, did you ever recover the goods?
At this point, Kathy and Barb, that's the biggest art heist in history. It was called the Isabella Stark Gardner Museum theft, and it's in Boston. It was in Boston in 1991. And in fact, we have not recovered those paintings. It's a real mystery because there were 13 pieces taken. About an hour and 15 minutes, these two individuals had gone into the museum on St. Patrick's Day night dressed as Boston police officers. They made their way in, stole the 13 pieces, and today they're valued at more than $500 million. None of them have been recovered, and two of them, very famous. One was a Rembrandt seascape known as the Storm Over the Sea of Galilee, and the other is a Vermeer called the Concert. It's the only one missing in the world. So it's still out there. And just to let your listeners know, there's a $5 million reward for the recovery of the paintings.
Ooh, we'll keep our eyes open.
Absolutely. I'll go to lots of museums. You know what I don't understand, Robert? When somebody steals this very famous work of art, do they think they're going to sell it like on eBay? What do they do with it?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, whenever these pieces are taken, I mean, not long ago, just the second week of October of 2012, there was a big heist in Rotterdam in Holland, and basically seven pieces were taken, valued at more than $65 million. And what these thieves find out is that in the end, the real art and art theft is not the stealing, it's the selling. And that's how they get caught when these things come back to market. They think out the crime. They do a good job with that. They're good thieves. They're involved in different types of criminal enterprises. And so what they do is they plan it out, they get away with it, but then they never think about what they're going to do with it. And that's the real problem for them.
They kind of sound like stupid thieves, actually. I mean, if they were good businessmen, wouldn't you think they'd have a real plan for, you know,
a customer?
Like, maybe they need some marketing advice.
Yeah, there's no degree in thievery.
That's right.
you don't get a business degree in thievery, so you know that's the problem. And that's what they run into, and thank goodness for that. That's why we get these pieces back.
Let's talk about how you even begin to do your work and recover these works of art. How does someone like you even begin to go undercover and hang out with the mob? I mean, you can't exactly Google them. You can't look them up in the Yellow Pages. How do you make your connections?
Are they on Craigslist?
There you go. I talk about that a lot in my book. I mean, different techniques for working undercover. You know, in my career, I guess I was doing this for 20 years with the FBI, and then I've been out for 4 years now doing it privately. I've been lucky enough to recover $300 million worth of this stolen art and cultural property. And a lot of it's through the undercover technique, but oftentimes working at the FBI, I didn't go undercover. You know, that's a technique that's used, just like wiretaps, just like regular investigation, that when it's necessary to do it, then we use it. If not, you know, I'd rather just do an overt investigation and go out and ask questions. Now, the way you get into it, there's different ways. And like I say, in the book, Priceless, I talk about, there's an entire chapter about how undercover techniques are started, you know, how they're used, different tips on what to do, which, you know, I find interesting because readers can look at that and actually use those techniques in their everyday lives in their businesses and whatnot in order to enhance their sales and enhance their own personal lives.
Well, Robert, can you give us an example of an undercover technique that you used?
Well, you know, one of the things that we talk about, you know, in the book is how a technique is started. You know, undercover operations are started by one of two things. Either we call a vouch, which is where someone introduces, like maybe an informant or someone who's trying to work off a prison sentence or something of that nature is going to introduce the undercover agent to the potential targets. And the other is through what we call a bump. So it's a vouch and a bump. And the bump is where, you know, you plan out a perchance meeting, and then you follow through on that perchance meeting, and then create, of course, it's not perchance, it's all set up, but then you create, you know, your rapport with the individual, and then continue from there. So that's one of the things that we look at is whether or not how to go into a case is either through the bump or the vouch.
Well, I'm always curious, how they must do research on you. I mean, if I was a thief and I had stolen all of these great masterpieces and people that I'm going to meet with that I don't know, I would be certainly doing research. Do you disguise yourself? I mean, do you wear glasses and a wig?
Do you wear a liar?
Yeah, I wear a Groucho nose.
Yeah, do you? You know, a mustache?
That's
what do you do?
Jeffy's not a thief, I think.
Now, that's another technique, you know, that we talk about in the book, and that is that, you know, as an undercover agent, it's not like you're an actor on television or an actor in a movie. You know, Brad Pitt gets to make 10 tries at doing something. I mean, they cut the thing and they cut the tape or whatever, the video, and go back and forth. They might do it 100 times before it's done. Whereas, you know, in an undercover scenario, you're by yourself, you have to do it once. And then sometimes if you do it wrong, you know, it could cost you your life. So basically, you don't get a million chances to try to do it right.
And then
so what I say is that, you know, what we need to do and what undercover agents should do is keep everything as close to true as possible. Because the more lies you tell, the more you have to remember down the road. And that's how you slip up.
And then how do you gain the confidence of these people? Do you actually become friends with them?
Yeah. Well, that's part of it. You have to build a rapport. And when you build that rapport, sometimes, you know, you have to identify good things about people. I mean, we all have good traits. I mean, whether you're a criminal or not a criminal or whatever, we all have, you know, common good traits. So you just keep your focus on those good traits to build that rapport so that you could, you know, get past their, you know, the evil parts.
You know, I would never make a good undercover agent. I'd be too nervous.
That's why she's on radio.
That's why I would blow it totally.
That's why you're on radio?
Yeah, exactly. This is Kathy and Barb, the Two Boomer Babes. Joining us is former FBI undercover agent Robert Whitman, who spearheaded the recovery of hundreds of millions of dollars worth of masterpieces and historic artifacts. Let's talk a bit about the Rembrandt's self-portrait that was worth $36 million. And that was really an incredible assignment. You actually worked with an Eastern European mob group,
right? Well, in that case, I was posing as an authenticator for an Eastern European mob group. And the reality was there was no mob group. It was just that was the story we had set up, you know, as part of the undercover.
Oh, my goodness.
That we had told them that, yeah, we were posing for them and that they were paying for it. And if everything was right, they would be putting up the money and that, you know, I was the buyer authenticator for them. And that's how we kind of played it out. Ended up doing it in Copenhagen. That particular painting was stolen in 2000 in an armed robbery from the National Museum in Stockholm. It was a Rembrandt self-portrait, and it was the only one he ever done on copper, so it's unique. It was done in 1630 when Rembrandt was 24 years old.
Another amazing heist that you talk about in your book, which was really like Ripley's Believe It or Not, was the one that happened at the University of Pennsylvania Museum and the unlikely discovery of one of the stolen pieces at a thrift shop, no less. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, that was a number of years before. What happened there was the museum at the University of Pennsylvania is a 5-star archaeological anthropological museum. It's a fabulous place, and I recommend anyone to go there to look at these artifacts. Well, what had happened was on an evening, a number of individuals went in. They stole a statue of the god Osiris, which is the god of the dead from Egypt. It was made around 1000 BC, and it was valued at around $100,000 at the time. They also stole a crystal ball. It's the second largest crystal ball in the world, and it was owned by the Dowager Empress of China and collected around 1930. It weighed about 50 pounds, so it's the second largest. The largest is in the Smithsonian. anyway, they took these both of these pieces, and we did an investigation. It took us about 2 years. Finally, the God Osiris popped up in a secondhand thrift shop on South Street in Philadelphia, and it was actually seen by one of the employees at the museum who turned it in. And as a result, we were able to conduct the investigation. We went backwards from there and found where the crystal ball had been. And it was given away. And believe it or not, the person it was given to was a witch. So,
oh, I guess she'd need the ball.
Yeah, a witch has got to have a crystal ball,
right? Of course.
Absolutely.
But you know what? Thank goodness she was a good witch.
Oh, good.
So we were able to get it back from her as well. We recovered both pieces.
And then whatever happened to her?
Nothing, because she didn't steal it. She actually was a housekeeper, and she was keeping the house for this fellow who owned this townhouse on South Street, who found it in his backyard. So we surmise that what happened was these pieces were so heavy that the thieves who took them probably dumped them because they didn't really want to carry them anymore, and it could have actually been a frat prank. You know, it was at the University of Pennsylvania.
Oh.
We have some suspicions that it might have been, you know, college kids who had gone into some kind of a search or something and got away with these pieces and didn't know what to do with them.
You know those UPenn frat boys.
Yeah, they're probably investment bankers in New York
yeah.
now making millions.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's how it goes.
Robert, you write about calling your wife just before you embark on an undercover assignment. Did your family know what you were doing with the FBI?
Well, they knew that I was, that I was an agent, that I was working undercover, and my wife knew, of course, where I was. I would always tell her where I was going. And then what I would do is, as I say in the book, I would call her before I actually went into the meets, just to let her know, you know, we're going. And then I'd call her when we came out so that she wouldn't worry. So we kept a good conversation going all the time.
Well, did you
and
ever
on top of that, it also kind of gave me a chance to think about the real world and to, calm down a bit and think about the kids and the family so that when I did go in, I was always focused.
It would keep you grounded, I would imagine.
Absolutely.
But did you ever worry? I mean, here you would be turning in members of the mob, and I don't know, it always sounds so scary. Did you ever fear for your family?
There's sort of an unwritten, law that, you know, as a police officer, you know, you're doing your job. And basically the mob and the criminals, they're doing their job. That's what they do. It's their job to commit these crimes and get away with it and monetize them, and it's my job to catch them. So to a certain degree, you know, getting caught is the cost of doing business for them. Oftentimes the people that I caught would smile and look at me and go, I knew it. They'd always say, I knew it. Okay? And if they had known it, they probably wouldn't have done what they did, you know, but they always said that. And because of the way that I kind of handled it, I think that most of the times they didn't have any problem with it. They were not happy they got caught, but they didn't have anything against me.
Well, Robert Rittman, former FBI art sleuth and co-author of Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures, thanks so much for sharing this remarkable story with the two Boomer Babes.
Oh, it's great to talk to you both. And being a Boomer guy, it's fun to talk to the Boomer Babes.
Up next, are you more like Dr. Spock or Homer Simpson when it comes to making decisions? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
When it comes to decision making, we are less like the hyper-rational Mr. Spock and more like the vindictive, emotional, and biased Homer Simpson. So says Dan Ariely, a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University. But Ariely says the good news is it's not all bad to be like Homer Simpson, at least when it comes to making decisions.
In his latest book, The Upside of Irrationality, Dan Ariely draws practical conclusions from real-life experiments. He explores how we can get the most good and the least bad out of ourselves when it comes to making choices about money, relationship, and our own happiness. Dan also writes the Ask Ariely column for the Wall Street Journal. Pleasure to have you on the show, Dan.
Well, my pleasure.
Very briefly, how did you get interested in this line of work?
So I was very badly injured many years ago, and I spent a long time in hospital. And hospitals give people lots of opportunities to observe irrational behaviors. And in my particular case, I was most concerned with the question of how you remove bandages from burn patients. And the nurses thought that the right approach is to rip the bandages of the burn patients, and I thought this was the bad approach. And we used to argue. And when I left the hospital, I started doing experiments on this. I basically would hurt people in different patterns over time, and I found that the nurses were wrong. And from that point on, I started thinking about all kinds of ways in which people have an intuition, an idea about what's the right thing to do, but we are wrong. And that's kind of my motto, is to basically kind of try to figure out what are people doing wrong and how can we fix it.
Well, you do some real life experiments that Kathy and I can certainly relate to. And one of them was the idea of getting something for free, which of course sends our consumer hearts racing, even if that something really isn't. And we see this all the time with those buy one, get one free one offers, or you go to a cosmetic counter and they give you a free something and other if you buy a very expensive cosmetic that you don't really need.
Kind of like Joseph Banks, you know, you buy a suit, you get five free.
Exactly. So why do we fall for this?
Well, what happens is that the moment we think about something as being free, we think about the benefits, but we don't think about the cost. Now, the interesting thing is many times there's cost with free. For example, if you have to stand for an hour and a half waiting in line for something, there's a cost to it, but we just don't naturally think about that. And because of that, we just see the positive, and therefore we make some mistakes.
So if we have the right intuition, why do we do the wrong thing?
So first of all, it's not always the case that we have the right intuition. But even when we have the right intuition, sometimes things like emotion take over. So just think about the problem of what's called self-control, which is what's good for now versus what's good for later. Just think to yourself, in the last month, have you eaten more than you think you should? Have you exercised less than you think you should? Have you saved less money? Have you texted and drove? I mean, when we look at all of those behaviors, these are things that we know in principle what's good for us, but in practice, we don't feel like doing it right now. And that's just one other example of an irrational behavior, and it's all about the emotion at the moment and how it influences us.
Maybe that's just all part of being human.
It is part of being human, and you know what's also interesting is that it's not all bad. Right? So there's some things about irrationalities, for example, our generosity or caring about other people. The fact that if somebody stops you on the street, you might give them good advice or help them out. All of those things are non-rational in the sense that with perfect rationality, you only should care about your own benefits. But nevertheless, they're really quite wonderful. So we really need to think about what are the cases in which irrationality is bad, what are the cases in which irrationality is good, and when it comes to bad irrationalities, what can we do about it? How can we fight it? How can we improve things?
Well, Dan, you also did a really fascinating experiment about relativity where you showed that a high-paying executive doesn't necessarily make him happier than someone else. Now, tell us about that one.
So there's lots of things about compensation that we actually don't understand very well. And one of the things we don't understand about compensation is that what people are really happy about is the feeling of relative satisfaction, not absolute satisfaction. So I'll give you a very different example. In the Olympics a few times ago, they basically took pictures of people who won medals. And they try to analyze how big was their smile. And what you would think, you would say, oh, the gold would smile the most, silver would smile less, and bronze would smile the least. But what they actually find out is that the happiest people are the gold, but the saddest people are the silver. Why? Because imagine that you practiced for the last 3 years to get for the Olympics. And at a few moments ago, you won the silver medal. And now ask yourself, under those conditions, what are you thinking, right? And most people think, oh, I could have got it. I am so close. And if you got the bronze, you're happier because you're comparing yourself to the people who won nothing. So what's interesting is our happiness in many cases is not really driven by where we are. It's driven by where we think we could have been. And happiness with salary is not very different, where you often say to yourself, what could I have made? And if you think you could have made more money, you become unhappy.
Aren't we also talking a little bit about envy? Like, let me give you a quick example. Like, if we upgrade to a bigger house in a nicer neighborhood, there's always going to be somebody that has more, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And envy is basically a comparison, right? It's about comparing where you are to where you could have been. And now the question is this comparison making you happy or making you miserable?
We are speaking with behavioral economics professor Dan Ariely about how irrationality shapes our decisions. We'll be right back after the break.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up at 5.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is Barb and Kathy, the two Boomer Babes, and our guest is behavioral economics professor Dan Ariely. Dan, what is the one experiment you've done whose findings have most surprised you?
I have done some experiments on placebos, and placebos are really interesting. Placebos are there because our body prepares to change the physiology and can do it. So placebos for pain are the most interesting. When you are anticipating a pain relief from, for example, a physician who gives you an injection, your body prepares for that. Your body secretes substance that is very much like morphine. And as a consequence of that, you actually feel less pain. So even if the physician gives you nothing but an injection with some saline water, you actually feel pain relief. And we've shown that, and we've shown that if you think the medication is cheaper, it works worse, and if you think the medication is expensive, it works better. But the thing that surprised me the most is we just finished a set of studies showing that it even works for things like vision. So, for example, we gave people some bright light, and in front of it, we put some reading materials. It was very hard to read. And some people, we told them that the sunglasses that they were using to filter the brightness out were made by Armani, and for some people, we told them it was made by some really bad manufacturer. And what happened, people were actually able to read better. So for me, this was kind of a new height of what placebos and expectations do. We understand that expectations will change, you know, how you feel about wine, if you think it's better or worse, but the idea that they actually influence things like the ability to see, that for me was a big surprise.
Dan, Barb and I were talking about our own irrational decision making, and we might go to 5 different stores, cut our coupons, you know, get up at 5 in the morning to stand in line to save a few bucks, and then we'll splurge on like some designer handbag. Now tell us why we do this wacky stuff.
Help us, please.
Please.
Basically, one of the things that is happening is a concept called depletion. And depletion is the idea that as we try very hard to resist temptation, we actually get tired of resisting temptation. So, you know, you go to the office and there's a muffin and you resist it, and then you go and there's some sale and you resist it, and then there's YouTube and Facebook and so on, and you resist temptation, until at some point in the day you basically you just fed up, you're tired, and you fail. And we see this pattern where earlier in the day people are able to resist temptation in a much better way. So one suggestion is to think about your day and to think about this idea of depletion and to take the tasks that require more self-control and try to do them earlier in the day, and the tasks that require less self-control and try to do them later in the day. And this should actually help you to some degree.
Dan, you know what really scares me about this conversation is if we assume that humans behave irrationally, what does that say about people in powerful positions who are making these life-altering decisions for us, like politicians? And what about if we're about to have brain surgery? You know, this is a pretty scary thing.
First of all, you know, we should realize that there are many cases in which we might not be optimal, but people do reasonable decisions, but it's for sure not all the time. Because of that, we really need to think very carefully about what are the constraints that we put on people. So if people fail all the time and we have a tendency to fail, the question is what system we are creating. So, for example, think about the banking system, right? The banking system gives people tremendous bonuses if they can only see reality phrased in a slightly different way, right? For example, imagine that you were a banker in 2005 and I would give you $5 million a year if you could only see mortgage-backed securities as a good product. Now ask yourself if with this amazing incentive, you wouldn't be able to see them as a better product than they really are. And the answer is, of course you would. And what would happen if I gave you some ideology of the free market? And what would happen if everybody around you saw the same thing? And what happened if mortgage-backed securities were difficult and complex to compute? Now you can see how we're designing a system that will basically tempt people to fail in magnificent ways and not realize that they're failing. You know, in the same way that I could come every morning to your desk and cover it with donuts and the odds are that you will gain some weight at the end of the year, if we create systems that tempt people in bad ways, we should expect them to fail, and we see it sadly too often. But if we understood our irrationalities, I think we actually could do better.
Well, I'd go for the donuts. Well, this has been fascinating, but unfortunately, we have to go. Behavioral economics professor Dan Ariely, author of The Upside of Irrationality, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
My pleasure.
Up next, from somber and grim to parades and parties, surprising ways to make an exit. Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Up next, making in-laws into family. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
To say most people don't like talking or even thinking about death, especially their own. But when Sarah Murray's father died, it got her thinking. How do other cultures celebrate and mourn their dead? She decided to hit the road to find out.
What she learned made her slightly less terrified about death and gave her inspiration and ideas for her own eventual demise. Her book is aptly titled Making an Exit, From the Magnificent to the Macabre, How We Dignify the Dead. Delighted to have you on the show, Sarah.
It's great to be here.
Hey, I'm dying to know. I couldn't help that one. What did you learn that made you slightly less terrified about death?
Well, I think it was just something I had never, ever thought about before. What I found very inspiring about going on this journey and looking at different cultures and actually, you know, immersing myself in this subject that I hadn't really approached before, was it really, for me, it kind of reinforced the fact that thinking about death actually makes you value life much more. I mean, if you know, life is a limited supply, it makes it far more valuable.
We know at the beginning of the book that you talk about your dad passing away, and that got you interested in looking at how other cultures mourn the dead. How did you go from A to B?
That's right. It was a very personal beginning to this journey. My father had always, during his lifetime, said that he really felt that once you were dead, the body had nothing to do with you. It was just some organic matter, and you should really just we should dispose of it in the most efficient way possible. And he was not one for any great ceremonies at all. So he said, I don't want a funeral. He hated long speeches. So he really didn't want us to make any fuss at all. And we all in the family agreed and said, yes, that's great, but could you write it down, because people are going to wonder why we're not having a funeral for you. And it was in this document that I really got surprised, because, as expected, he said, well, yes, I want no funeral, and you can take me off in a cardboard box, whatever's most practical. But then he had this very specific request about having his ashes scattered in a very beautiful part of Dorset where we all lived. And the fact that he wanted to be in a churchyard, not because of religious reasons, but near his two best friends who were buried there. At which point I really thought, well, this is a big change for him, because he's now actually, you know, giving his remains some sort of significance and thinking about where they should go. And I suppose I thought, well, you know, if even my incredibly pragmatic secular father in the end thinks this is an important thing to consider, then, clearly I need to start looking into this. And I guess combined with that, I've always been a great traveler, but I like traveling with a purpose. And so this really gave me an amazing purpose as a means to discovering different cultures around the world.
Let's talk about some of those travels. And you took off, one of your stops was to Ghana, where you found a rather interesting tradition of burials using very elaborate coffins, to say the least. Tell us about a few of them.
Ghana, yes, there's an absolutely spectacular tradition where you can be buried in a coffin shaped in anything you like. So they tend to reflect people's lives. So often you'll get a giant fish painted in beautiful bright colors for a fisherman, a sack of flour for a miller. Sometimes it's more to do with aspirations. So there were a lot of, I saw some, you know, brightly colored Mercedes cars, for example.
Oh, wow.
No Toyota Corollas, huh?
No, we aim for the top in death.
That must be a fancy neighborhood.
Yes, that's right. but they were really, you know, they really struck me because they were, you know, they were not this grim, you know, black wooden boxes that we're so used to in the West. They were actually incredibly celebratory and actually funny and fun. So I just thought they were marvelous and actually decided to commission one for myself.
Well, we're going to ask you about that.
But it wasn't for your own demise, we hope.
Hopefully not.
Tell us about the Coke bottle. I was fascinated by that one.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's so fascinating about them is that because a lot of them are objects like a Coke bottle or a giant mobile phone, I saw beer bottles as well, you know, it's actually, you get to go into the ground standing up, which is a slightly unusual way to go. But there were elephants, there were giant crabs, you name it, anything you want is possible.
And you said you commissioned one for yourself. Which one did you commission?
Well, I had to think long and hard about it because, you know, if something reflected my life as a writer, I thought, well, you know, a pen is really too, not very creative and inspiring. And a computer mouse or a computer is just the wrong shape. And who wants to be associated with technology and death? And I just thought, I couldn't come up with anything. So I decided to go for the my favorite object, which is actually a building in New York. It's the Empire State Building.
Mm-hmm.
So I now have a coffin shaped in the form of the Empire State Building.
Oh, my.
What
is
do you
that
use
like
it
in your,
for?
Is that in your apartment, or where do you keep it?
It is in my apartment. It's quite large. If I had a slightly bigger apartment, I think I would use it as a cocktail cabinet because it's a great art deco shape. It's actually now in my basement for the moment.
You know, I'm thinking if it had drawers, that could be a great jewelry curio, you know,
yes.
Holder.
Right, or an old photo cabinet or something.
Absolutely.
We could use it.
Yeah.
We can put that to good
and,
use.
You know, that takes us round to another area, which is, you know, you can actually now get coffins which have photo drawers in them so that you can take your favorite things off with you to the grave. So that would make a lot of sense.
This is the Two Boomer Babes, and we're speaking with journalist Sarah Murray about her new book, Making an Exit, From the Magnificent to the Macabre, How We Dignify the Dead. Sarah, you also visited the Czech Republic, and you discovered their tradition of ossuary. Is ossuary? How do you even pronounce it, and what is it?
An ossuary is a bone, in short, it's a bone house, a house for the bones. And this one dated back to the Middle Ages. They were quite common in Europe at that time. People were being buried in large numbers because of the Black Death, and cemeteries very quickly got filled up. So there was a tradition of unearthing the bones after a certain number of years. And in this particular one, there had been so many bones left there because it was seen as a very, very holy church, and everybody wanted to be buried there. And so eventually they had so many bones, they were really piling up in these huge, great pyramids. And in the 19th century, the person who owned the chapel decided to commission a sculptor to come up with something interesting. And so the bones are now these incredible decorations, like Christmas festoons. There's a giant chandelier made entirely out of human bones. It was the most extraordinary church decoration I've ever seen in my life, and one wonders if the people who died would ever have imagined that they would end up in a chandelier, for example.
Oh my goodness, that's giving me ideas for Christmas ornaments.
Oh, absolutely, or Christmas presents.
Imagine
why not?
A femur hanging from your
They'll
tree.
Never know.
Absolutely, that's a strange thought.
Well, speaking of really creepy, perhaps the creepiest was the one the tradition that you found in Sicily, where you visited. I hope I'm pronouncing this one right. The Capuchin Catacombs of Palermo, which happened to be right next to the Sexy Duck lingerie shop. I mean, what did you find there?
It was in a very funny little suburb of town, it must be said. And this was a place that was very famous in the 18th and 19th centuries. Again, it was a very popular burial place for middle class and wealthy people. But they thought they'd found a way of preserving the bodies. And in this chapel, there are about 8,000 corpses, fully dressed in Victorian finery, hanging on the walls. And what makes it so bizarre is the fact that these clothes, I suppose they thought they were going to be better preserved, but of course, years on, they're now drooping and dusty, and somehow it just makes the whole place look incredibly macabre. So I must say that was quite a creepy experience.
Sarah, you also discovered that there are significant differences between funeral traditions between the British and Americans. And Americans, for example, like open caskets, which is creepy in itself. Tell us about it.
Yeah, this was a very interesting experience for me because, coming from the UK, we've started to do open coffins, but it's not a very widespread tradition. Certainly nothing like it is in America. And I learned actually that it had started during the Civil War when there was suddenly a huge need to transport bodies home for funerals from the battlefield. But to me, it was an interesting experience to look into this because, I was going to these very exotic places, India, Bali, Mexico, Ghana, all over the world. And yet in some ways, to me, the embalmed body, fully dressed, made up, with, little objects of familiarity placed in the coffin. I mean, to me, this is every bit as exotic as things that I've seen elsewhere around the world.
And then we hear that some of these mementos that are placed in the coffin are like a fully charged pay-as-you-go cell phone. I mean, talk about denial.
That's right. There was a woman who buried her husband with her cell phone. Apparently, he had loved talking on his phone. And she charged it up. I suppose the charge didn't last that long, but she managed to pay the subscription so that at least the voicemail would activate. And she even put the phone number on the gravestone.
What a riot. Well, real quickly, Sarah, now that you're quite an expert on funeral options, do you have any plans for how you want your own funeral to go down, which we hope is very far off, by the way?
Me too, yes. But, somehow I think that thinking about this, having a plan, I think, makes it a lot better. And I really don't think enough of us think about this. And when it comes, our relatives are left to deal with this. So I actually made the last chapter of the book, what everybody's going to do with my remains. And, of course, being a great traveler, it involves taking them to all my favorite parts around the world, parts of the world that I've traveled to. But there was one final thing I also wanted to do, because one of the most spectacular funerals I saw was a royal cremation in Bali when the bodies are burnt in these spectacular decorated bulls and go up in a burst of flames. And I did find that there are companies now that will put your remains in with some fireworks, and you can have a massive firework display. And I thought, well, that's a good way to go.
Sarah Murray, author of Making an Exit. This has been somehow fun and not too morbid. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you. It was great talking with you.
Up next, the babes shoot the breeze about the booming business of pet funeral homes.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, and son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Today, we're shooting the breeze with Bob Walchick, owner and operator of two funeral homes, one for humans and one for pets. Since launching Forever Friends, the pet-only offshoot about 10 years ago, sales are up by more than 500%, and that's no fluke. Today, there are about 700 pet funeral homes nationwide. Business is heavenly. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. Bob Walchick joins us from his funeral home in Green Bay, Wisconsin. Welcome to Two Boomer Babes, Bob.
Thank you.
Bob, do you offer the same type of services for pets, our heavenly friends, as you do for their owners?
What we've established is a standalone facility. We call it a dedicated facility, and it is across the street from our human funeral home. We have a cremation unit right in that building, along with a room for family viewing and a nice living room atmosphere type of a setting when they first walk in. A lot of things that they can pick from as far as keepsakes or urns. Markers for gardens or cemeteries if they wish. But what we try to do is mirror the services that we provide at our human funeral home. We have a library, we have a newsletter, we have a viewing area. So we've really tried to raise the bar, I guess, and not be considered a disposal facility for pets.
And Bob, we understand that when people come to your human-only funeral home and you tell them how much it costs to cremate grandpa, shall we say, it's never cheap enough. But then when you tell them the price to cremate their beloved pet, they take out their checkbook, no questions asked. So that is pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's something that we didn't really realize. We took about 2 years to do a little research on if this was something that was wanted or needed in our area. It's kind of a niche market. And what we found out is after we opened up that was the case, that people would come to the human funeral home, even with discounted packages for cremation. They decided that it was never going to be cheap enough, I guess. But when they came over with a pet, they didn't really question the cost. You know, we have different types of cremations, so what we do is offer the three types and let the family select what they want, and then following that, we follow up just like we would with a family from our funeral home, and they even when you're done with the arrangements, they seem to just give you the credit card or ask how much the check should be made out to.
How much are we talking about for a pet's funeral? What's the range?
Oh, you know, a general amount with if they purchase an urn or some type of keepsake jewelry and a cremation for, you know, an average sized dog, for instance, you're looking at $200 to $300. So I think when they come in, they're expecting to pay more actually, and a lot of people will say that that's not what we thought. It's a lot less than we expected to pay, and we try to make it affordable for everybody. And we do have different price ranges according to weight. We also found that what we call pocket pets would be like the hamsters and the gerbil and the fish. We had families that were not calling us because the cost is a little too high. So when we kind of developed that class of pocket pets, it's just a flat fee for all the smaller pets like that. A lot of times it's a child's first experience with death is when a pet dies, and we really wanted them to come in and understand what that was about. So that has really helped our market share here also.
And real quickly, Bob, are boomers your biggest customers?
Yes, I would say that would be the largest majority of the people that we serve. We do have some of the elderly people that after a spouse dies, the pet becomes their closest companion at the home, you know. So that's a smaller segment. But the majority is going to be the boomers, yes. They know what they want. They're willing to pay for the services. We are a little more expensive than our competition, but we also, again, have a dedicated facility and offer services that nobody else offers around here. So,
funeral homeowner Bob Walchick, thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the babes.
Thank you.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up.
For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Achoo! Gesundheit, Barbara! Ah, yes, the flu season is upon us.
Well, last year's flu season hit harder and earlier than expected and saddled Americans with this nasty bug. But since we're now in the midst of this year's flu season, it's important that we mind our manners, flu manners that is, to avoid spreading that dreaded virus.
Joining us from Burlington, Vermont is Anna Post, great-great-granddaughter of the iconic Emily Post and co-author of Emily Post's Etiquette 18th edition. Anna joins us to shoot the breeze about the do's and don'ts during flu season. Welcome, Anna.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we Bays were so really happy to learn that the Emily Post Institute and the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases has partnered to get the word out this flu season. Alleluia. And we Bays really applaud you for that. So we know it's important to wash our hands almost to the point of, you know, making them raw. But what else can we do to be proactive, which is only polite, right?
Absolutely. A lot of the same behaviors that are good, polite etiquette are also really helpful at helping you to prevent the spread of flu. So, you know, this includes, you know, measures like you said, washing your hands regularly. If you need to cough or sneeze, it's funny, I know actually a lot of kids are ahead of the curve on this one these days, into your elbow instead of, you know, obviously out into the air or even into your hand. Or if you use a tissue to blow your nose, one and done. Throw it away. Don't hold on to it. Don't go for those old-fashioned hankies, even though they may seem like they're a throwback to something from an older day of etiquette.
Like your grandmother tucking them in her brassiere.
Yes, exactly. I actually have an old hanky of Emily's, but this is not the right time to be using that. You know, flu is so highly contagious, as you know, and that's one of the reasons why it's not just about those preventative actions, but it's about our social interactions, too. And etiquette really comes into play here. You know, whether you have a meeting at work, your child has a play date, this is the time to cancel.
Okay, but what about if we're in an office situation or we're meeting new people or we're at some kind of a party? How do you avoid shaking hands with somebody or even giving them a hug?
Without looking rude.
Yeah. Should we do that elbow bump like President Obama?
You can always go for that. You can also just put your hands up in front of you and kind of just, you know, shrug your shoulders a little and be friendly and say, you know, excuse me for not shaking hands, but it's great to see you. Now, if you know this person, you should probably do at a party or if you're at work, you can also probably use a little caring concern and say, you know, you're not looking so hot. Are you sure you shouldn't be heading home and contacting your doctor instead? You know, this could be flu. You know,
I'd be insulted if somebody said that to me.
Well, it's got to be the right person, and you have to be friendly and caring more than that ew tone of voice. This is why it's a really good idea this time of year to know what the signs of flu actually are, to distinguish it from a cold. The word facts, if you can remember flu facts, fever is the F, A is aches, C is chills, T is tiredness, and S, this one might be the most important. This stands for sudden onset. This is that feeling like you've just been hit by a ton of bricks out of nowhere. That helps you to know that this might not just be a cold, but that you should contact your doctor because prescription antiviral flu medicines might be available, but you have to catch it within 48 hours of symptoms first showing up because those may be able to help you feel better faster.
Well, Anna, what about if we're on a plane? And, of course, as our luck would have it, you know, we're sitting next to this person that's sneezing and sniffling and, you know, making all sorts of disgusting noises. And what is a person to do when their hands all over that armrest, too?
I like to travel with a little pack of tissues and some alcohol-based, that's important, hand sanitizer. This may feel forward to some people, but it's better than this person coughing all over you when you can't change, you know, an airline seat. By offering a tissue or some hand sanitizer, you're sort of, you know, helping them help you a little bit at the same time.
Well, finally, Anna, can you just give us three top flu tips to leave our listeners with?
The CDC's Take Three to Fight Flu is, number one, to get an annual flu vaccine. This will help you to not have to cancel parties or things like that because you won't be coming down with flu in that case. Number two, take those everyday preventative actions we talked about, you know, covering your cough or sneeze, staying home from playdates if kids are sick, and taking antiviral medicines if your doctor prescribes them. You can also find out more about how to prevent the spread of flu, and also there's a helpful flu tracker at flufacts.com.
Well, Anna Post, co-author of Emily Post Etiquette 18th Edition, thanks so much for sharing these flu etiquette tips with the two boomer babes.
You are very welcome. Thanks so much for having me.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.